Okay, this is continuing with Robert Price on 17 August 1981. So you were saying that perhaps you didn't even, you heard about one of these other efforts, and that may have been what inspired you. You're not sure.
Gardel may have already advertised that they were going after this.
You're not immune to wanting some bit of publicity, of course.
But it was Paul's impression that I came up with the idea, but I don't know.
Well, ultimately it doesn't really matter. The point is that you did it. Now, can you tell me about the experiment itself? You say you only had four tries that you felt were worth looking at.
Right. Of course, we couldn't see anything until we got the plotters going, and the output, the processing and the output plotting, and the numbers coming out. We couldn't hear anything, obviously, coming back. You know.
That was your first try, just
there was nothing that, just casual inspection of the recordings themselves would reveal. So we had to go after it by integration. The IF filter, I think, was built right in the computer processing, but in 1959 we used pulse compression. I don't think we, as I remember, we didn't use it in 58, but it was a Barker sequence, 11 or 13 long, 1959, and in that case we had a tap delay line analog that whose output we recorded after the pulse compression.
I see.
But I'm jumping ahead of here. I think there were two good conjunctions in 58 and 59.
That's
two
correct.
Good opportunities.
Yeah.
Okay, I knew where to look. Rabe had the best claimed astronomical unit value. We knew this is an important subject because Jet Propulsion Laboratory was trying to find out where the planets were in order to send out their probes. We've been told that Robbie's was probably the most reliable. It was based on some small planetoid. Icarus, was it?
Icarus and Eros.
Eros. It was Eros. Right. And so many minutes of arc, the sun subtended at the Earth. I guess that's what the astronomical unit is, isn't it?
Well, the solar parallax is called,
Okay, so we went on that, and so I knew where to look, generally.
Right.
And I concentrated in that particular area around the Rabe value. And, you saw in the article in Science that the two correlation outputs for two of the runs didn't show anything, and two of them did. Individually, the peaks on those two runs weren't impressive. They were obviously stood up above anything else around, but together they did seem to constitute a very statistically significant measurement. So essentially, we integrated the two runs together.
But what about the two that didn't have anything? Did you throw them into?
No. And another thing, I guess you might say we fudged, was that there was an inexplicable 2 millisecond, as I recall, or 2.1 millisecond difference in time delay between those two peaks.
Between the two positive ones, I see.
Well, maybe we felt that there was an ionosphere or something that would be variable, and but we pointed out that there was this 2.1 millisecond discrepancy. We didn't readjust the data. We just felt that both represented essentially the same range measurement. Remember, the pulse itself was 2 milliseconds long, and so
maybe
put the
lost
two together
the count there or something.
Yeah. Well. But later on, and it took a couple of years, before an independent check on this could be done. We went ahead in 1959 and made more observations, but it wasn't until Caltech got a solid observation that differed seriously from ours that we knew something was wrong. So we thought we had it, but of course it would represent an unusually high albedo.
And it was, and this value was consistent with the Rabe.
Yes, it wasn't. It was within his optical limits.
Right.
later on, many years later, of course, it was found out why Robbie was so far off.
Yeah.
But he'd done an extremely thorough job, like the Millikan oil drop experiment, extremely conscientious, and everybody really believed in his value.
Right, right.
I also seem to recall the Russians could, they did an ambiguous experiment, and the peak could be interpreted to lie in any number of positions, but we were careful to do an unambiguous experiment. So later on, when the truth came out, I took a lot of time and carefully went over the tapes to see if there could have been, because everything was frozen digitally, mm-hmm. the tapes were still available, they hadn't aged too much, and I meticulously went over that to see if there could have been an error in our range measurement, and I came to the conclusion that we were absolutely solid, and those ranges that we measured were where those events were, mm-hmm. whether they false alarms or not, they could not possibly be brought into agreement with Caltech, and even if they could have been brought into agreement, there would have been still a suspiciously high albedo. So that was it. On the other hand, I have no reason to believe particularly that these were noise-caused false alarms. I don't know what they're caused by, but I still believe in the statistical significance of something mm-hmm. having happened, and I would like to just take the opportunity to point out, and it's in the record, that there was a tremendous solar storm during the time of our experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Worldwide blackouts. And we measured a range that was closer to, it was this side of Venus by the final determination
yes.
of the astronomical unit. What kind of phenomena such a solar storm might have created, I don't know.
There's a possibility.
I don't even know there's a possibility because I don't know that much about these physical models. I think, you know, if John Evans or Gordon Petten were asked whether there's a possibility of a halo surrounding Venus as a result of this storm, which is what I'm suggesting, they could probably dismiss that out of hand. On the other hand, perhaps in some future year of high sunspot activity, somebody might observe an anomalous range
sure.
again. But I've never heard of anybody observing an anomalous range since our experiment. All I can say is I have no reason to believe that it was noise-caused false
yep.
alarm.
Right.
It may have been man-made interference on the Earth getting in some
picture. Well, also it sounds like you don't think it was
Gaussian noise, what I mean.
Right.
It was not just caused by ordinary background.
Which you also doesn't, noise. Seems like you don't think it was some instrumental effect either.
No, the maser was conditionally stable. It was very marginal, but I was told at the time that it did behave itself well during the experiment. Maybe some other runs we discarded because we knew it had oscillated midway through the 5 minutes, something like that. But these four runs that we kept, presumably everything was all right
yeah.
with them.
Yeah.
I did scan them for any obvious local interference, you know, peaks suddenly coming up. Didn't see anything like that. I also divided each run in half and processed the first half, the second half, to see if a preponderant contribution came from the
right.
first half as against the second half, which indicated something inhomogeneous, and I couldn't see any signs of that.
Yeah.
There seemed to be a uniform buildup
yeah.
of the correlation peak. So
okay, well, we don't need to
yeah.
beat it to death. But now, okay, so you had this probable detection or something, and at the same time, however, Jodl came out saying they didn't see anything.
Well, but they did. No, I'm afraid that we encouraged them to publish a positive result.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I've got it. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, so
I should let you tell
John, the story. John Evans was sort of trapped into that bias because he believed we'd gotten the detection. He took a marginal peak and
at the same kind
it,
of range.
Yeah.
Right.
So we both fell into the same error. It's sort of like the detection of the magnetic monopulse when it's a very rare event, but it seems to be statistically
yeah.
significant. If there's the ability to get a lot of data over a long time, of course you don't have as much temptation. You can do a much more scientific approach. But since there was only a limited time of
right.
conjunction, we had to work with what we had.
Right.
And
so what was your attitude then after you had this obviously only a quick try, like you say,
well,
definitely to try it the next time it was available?
We went for 1959.
Right.
1959 was retroactively successful. That's where William Smith comes in. We made lots of recordings in 59, and nobody still knew what the astronomical unit was, and I don't recall what the details of the output recordings looked like, but Gordon Pettengill was convinced that we, well enough that we had received the signal, that he invited me to, for us to write a joint article, and I'm not sure that's in
your No, that's because it came out in 60.
Pettengill and Price. Something about a new determination of the astronomical unit, and it
right.
was intended, as I recall, to be refinement on our 58 observations, and I think it was probably still largely consistent with Robbie. Now, what we were seeing there, that's a paradoxical to me, because I really can't remember what we were seeing. So Gordon had better be consulted mm-hmm. on that.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of recordings were made and stored. And then when the value of the astronomical unit was reliably determined, first by jet propulsion and then confirmed by Lincoln Laboratory.
At which conjunction, though, are you referring to when you say reliably?
It seems to me something like 4 years went by.
So this would be the 61 conjunction.
I think I think it was 61 that Jet Propulsion Lab got it. They used CW techniques. So, and bistatic, too, I think. But that's another story.
And they had a 210 foot by then, didn't mm-hmm. they?
And Millstone as well, much more beefed up by then, too. I think they had parallel triple klystrons by then, probably at Millstone. So there was no longer any marginal observation, and both laboratories agreed. And I think there was a symposium held out at Caltech that was organized by Walter Victor, and those symposium proceedings might be worth mm-hmm. consulting when the real results started coming in. Well then, Bill Smith, knowing that we had made reliable recordings, was interested to go back and go over them and look in the proper range. And it was sort of like what the Australians did with the Jupiter noise. They went back over the
right.
records and there was the Jupiter noise when they had been told where to look, you know. So he, Bill used the processing program that I had mainly developed to its full power to study the Doppler profile as well as the range.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that he found anomalously narrow profiles spectrally, and he proposed the hypothesis that Venus was in locked rotation, and even in retrograde locked mm-hmm. rotation, which would make a unique object in the solar system. And he published that sole author. He invited other people to be authors with him, like me, Paul Green, but I guess we had been stung by our previous observations, and Bill really had done all this work himself. He used the tools that I had provided, but he really mm-hmm. did all the work himself.
Now this is 62 or something like this?
I guess so.
You're talking about analyzing...
The 1959 recordings.
59 recordings and 61, I guess, also?
Probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well I can check that paper.
And so, and Gordon Pettengill wrote an article recently in Scientific American, which he refers to Bill's discovery.
Mm-hmm. But now, how did he get any evidence of retrograde?
By studying the Doppler profile.
As Venus went across the sun.
Mm-hmm. And then he did some model fitting and came out with that possibility, which was accepted by the editor where he published Astrophysical Journal, maybe. I don't remember where that, but anyhow, it's with William B. Smith. And Gordon Pettengill is familiar with
sure.
the article. So that was definitely a Lincoln Laboratory original contribution to radar astronomy, a solid one,
right.
done by Smith and confirmed in due course. I think Erwin Shapiro also was... Erwin Shapiro was starting to do his general relativity experiments another contribution. Have you looked into that at all? The fourth test of general relativity?
No, I haven't. When does that really begin? I think it sort of begins at the end of my era. So I see.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. He got several hundred microseconds discrepancy, just as general relativity theory predicted.
And what time now?
What year?
Yeah.
That I don't remember. Yeah. But
I think that's a little bit later.
It was a significant experiment.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And he got a prize from the Franklin Institute for it, I believe. Yeah. Jet Propulsion Laboratory is also interested in that kind of thing. Mulliman. M-U-H-L-E.
Right, he's at this meeting, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Then, to wind it up, we gave a couple of, no, I guess one summer short course on radar astronomy, which was organized by John V. Harrington.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, a book came out of that that was published about 1964-65 with Evans and Hagfors
yes,
as the editor.
Right, I have that book. Yeah.
And we each contributed a chapter in our particular topic of interest. And the techniques that I worked up about optimum radiometry for active sensors, radar combined with radiometry, turned out also to be useful in sonar. I've been used for underwater sonar observations where you have similarly fluctuating signals.
Were you at all in contact with the traditional optical astrometers and astronomers over this period of 59 to 62, or were you just only sort of reading their articles?
The only thing I really needed was the ephemeris, and I got that from the Nautical Almanac.
Right.
Sort of taught myself how to use that.
But I mean, you weren't talking with them about to know really what is the reliable value of the AU and the way one does with. You were sort of apart.
It seemed to me that I asked somebody in a meeting whether Robbie's paper was the best, really the best unit around. I think I did ask an astronomer. I think I asked somebody down here at the Naval Research Observatory. I forget his name.
You mean the Naval Observatory? Or?
Yeah, the Naval Observatory.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. But I don't remember who that would have been. And that was about the only contact that I can remember. And I'm not even too sure of that one.
Now, how long did you stay in radar astronomy? Did you get out after the 61?
Yes. As I say, Bill Smith continued on.
Right.
But I got involved in a seismic detection system that Paul Green had been spearheading. Large aperture arrays, seismometers, to try to discriminate between bombs and underground.
Earthquakes, yeah.
Right.
So you weren't around for the Mercury experiments and so forth?
No, people would tell me what results they
got, I was always
interested to hear how the progress was being made there, but I was not in any active involvement at all.
Well, that pretty much covers what I wanted to talk about.
Okay, swell. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, one further topic is the solar radar.
Yes, the solar radar, and there's a chapter on it in the book,
that's
Radar
right.
Astronomy, was, I think, inspired by the Lincoln Lab officially got interested in radar astronomy after we had our apparent success.
Right.
And there was a strong group at Lincoln Laboratory in ionospheric propagation. James Chisholm was the head of that group. And there was a man there named Jesse James,
right,
who wrote the book, the chapter on solar radar astronomy. So a large installation was built in El Campo, Texas, using very high power HF.
Specifically for that purpose?
Specifically for bouncing echoes off the sun. Now, Stanford had also intended to do this, but a tragedy happened at Stanford. Their researcher got electrocuted in the transmitter room.
Huh.
And after that happened, they that badly damaged the morale, and they stopped and never proceeded.
What was his name? Dude?
I don't remember. Huh. Von Eshelman would remember the incident, so it was left to us to try to get the echoes from the sun. And so a big array was built down in El Campo with a limited amount of pointing. I think it was a transit observation.
Right.
Noon each day. And I have no doubt they got echoes. Steve Smerd was a consultant on that.
I see.
I designed a reverse-acting automatic gain control system because you were looking at an object here which had a tremendous amount of its own noise, and the noise background would fluctuate up and down seriously. So in order to do the radiometry optimally, you wanted to make a measurement on the side of the noise background and then weight down those times when you had intense background,
right,
play up those when the background was less. And so we interconnected a couple of R390 Army-type radio receivers, so the AGC, which would measure the total background on one, would cause attenuation in the other, and so you get an optimum radiometry.
So you were participating in this experiment?
Yes.
Yourself?
I was participating maybe 10% to the extent that I was interested in this particular processing technique. But it was Jesse James was the prime mover there, and the prime enthusiast. But I think after a year or two, the facility was shut down, and I don't think anybody had ever done solar or radar astronomy since then. And I don't know what the value was of the results that were ultimately obtained there, how they were used, what new interpretations they led to, I don't know.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say they didn't lead to very much, and that's why no more has been done.
I guess so.
You showed it was done, but then you didn't know what to do with it. It certainly wasn't astrometry, and you couldn't learn that much about the corona.
Right. So I just wanted to put that plug in.
Yes.
Because that was the era that you're...
And that was about what time?
It was done in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And, as I say, published in that book.
Right. Okay, so thank you.
Sure.
Okay, that ends the interview with Robert Price on 18 August, 17 August 1981.